Then he rewrote another computer language, Java, and his legend grew still further. Among Silicon Valley insiders, Joy is spoken of with as much awe as someone like Bill Gates of Microsoft. He is sometimes called the Edison of the Internet. As the Yale computer scientist David Gelertner says, Bill Joy is one of the most influential people in the modern history of computing. The story of Bill Joy's genius has been told many times, and the lesson is always the same. Here was a world that was the purest of meritocracies. Computer programming didn't operate as an old boy network where you got ahead because of money or connections. It was a wide open field in which all participants were judged solely by their talent and their accomplishments. It was a world where the best men won, and Joy was clearly one of those best men. It would be easier to accept that version of events, however, if we hadn't just looked at hockey and soccer players. Theirs was supposed to be a pure meritocracy as well, only it wasn't. It was a story of how the outliers in a particular field reached their lofty status through a combination of ability, opportunity, and utterly arbitrary advantage. Is it possible the same pattern of special opportunities operate in the real world as well? Let's go back over the story of Bill Joy and find out. For almost a generation, psychologists around the world have been engaged in a spirited debate over a question that most of us would have considered settled years ago. The question is this: is there such a thing as innate talent? The obvious answer is yes. Not every hockey player born in January ends up playing at the professional level. Only some do, the innately talented ones. Achievement is talent plus preparation. The problem with this view, though, is that the closer psychologists look at the careers of the gifted, the smaller the role innate talent seems to play, and the bigger the role preparation seems to play. Exhibit A in this argument is a study done in the early 1990s by the psychologist K. Anders Ericsson and two colleagues at Berlin's Elite Academy of Music. With the help of the Academy's professors, they divided the school's violinists into three groups. In the first group were the stars, the students with the potential to become world-class soloists. In the second were those judged to be merely good. In the third were students who were unlikely to ever play professionally and who intended to be music teachers in the public school system. All of the violinists would then ask the same question. Over the course of your entire career, ever since you first picked up the violin, how many hours have you practiced? Everyone from all three groups started playing at roughly the same time, around the age of 5. In those first few years, everyone practiced roughly the same amount, about 2 or 3 hours a week. But around the age of 8, real differences started to emerge. The students who would end up as the best in their class began to practice more than everyone else, 6 hours a week by age 9, 8 hours a week by age 12, 16 hours a week by age 14, and up until by the age of 20, they were practicing, that is, purposefully and single-mindedly playing their instruments with the intent to get better, well over 30 hours a week. In fact, by the age of 20, the elite performers had totaled 10,000 hours of practice over the course of their lives. By contrast, the merely good students had totaled 8,000 hours, and the future music teachers had totaled just over 4,000 hours.